2020 has been an interesting year, to put it mildly. The COVID-19 pandemic has taken the world by storm, and there's no denying that human society has been forever altered by its impact. Additionally, there's been a rallying cry that started from the United States and has spread across the world, a statement so obvious that it seems absurd to even say it. Black Lives Matter. It feels to me like the world is awakening to issues that have been existing for decades. As an African myself, a black person from Zimbabwe, it's been rather surreal for me to hear that combination of three words. That my life matters. But it seems necessary to say these words because some sectors of society simply believe different. For instance, the last years have seen a massive resurgence of the far right and the seemingly unstoppable rise of far-right ideology, whether it be in the United States, the Philippines, or Brazil. To resist this right-wing resurgence, it's necessary to understand its causes and to understand what's happening as part of a historical process. At least that's what the guest on today's episode believes. Welcome to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. My name is Sean Macheza. This episode of the podcast is based on a conversation I had with Walden Bello. Walden is the International Adjunct Professor of Sociology at the State University of New York and a retired professor from the University of the Philippines. He served in the House of Representatives in the Philippines from 2009 to 2015, and he is an associate of TNI. We had this conversation late last year when Walden was on a European tour promoting his book, Counter-Revolution, the Global Rise of the Far Right. This was way before the COVID-19 lockdowns and the beginning of the latest wave of Black Lives Matter protests. But what he had to say about the far right is as relevant today as it was then. In fact, with the events of 2020 now in perspective, Walden's thoughts are even rather prophetic.
Thank you very much for joining today on the podcast, Walden. So why counter-revolution? Why a book on the far right?
Well, I think that one is that one very obvious reason is that the far right is the most dynamic movement in the global north at this point in time. And one can make a case that in many parts of the global south, like the Philippines, India, Brazil, the far right is also very dynamic in terms of making a big impact on the political system. So that's the first reason. The second thing is why counter-revolution? It's because I felt that the way that people were trying to understand the right using the term populism, or authoritarian populism, really doesn't quite conceptually capture what these movements are all about. Because essentially, when you talk about populism, you're talking about a political style appealing to the people, a direct appeal to the people, and doesn't quite give you a sense of the substance of the program of the right.
So in a nutshell, how do we differentiate between the far right, populism, authoritarian populism, counter-revolution,
right,
and all these almost interchangeable terms?
Right. Now, the reason that I chose counter-revolution is because the far right is a reaction to progressive movements that you can best understand the emergence of the far right by looking at it from a revolution, counter-revolution dialectic. And if you look at the movements right now, counter-revolution can either be seen as a response to a lower class insurgency. And we've seen this in quite a number of places in the South. Or you could see it as a response to a failed ideology or a failed sort of framework, like liberal democracy, which, you know, you see characterizes many of these movements in the both the global north and the south. So I think if you bring in the fact that these are movements that counter, you know, insurgent movements from the progressive perspective, then it gives you a better sense of what they're really all about. They're not creative. They're basically countering.
Reactive.
They're reactive. Okay. Yeah. But they are reactive in a way that's different from just the simple dictator or the simple authoritarian movement, in the sense that they have a mass base, the most articulate of which is the middle class, and they're connected to charismatic individuals. Okay. Mm-hmm. So these are not, for instance, Duterte in the Philippines is not a Marcos. Marcos was sort of an isolated dictator, mm-hmm. you know.
But this is a dictator who has a significant level of mass support.
Yes. Yeah. And they're not antithetical mm-hmm. to democracy. Mm-hmm. Because in fact, like if you take Modi in India and you take Duterte in the Philippines, they use elections. They use elections, democracy. Get the majority in order to come to power. Yeah. And in fact, if they manipulated elections now, it would detract from their program. So the more spontaneous the support from them that comes out in the electoral process, the more legitimacy they have. And I think this is the character of these people that you cannot just capture by saying that they're from the right, they're authoritarian, they're dictators, you know. They have aspects of all of those, but those words do not capture the way they really are in a way that the word counter-revolutionary or counter-revolutionary captures it. Mm-hmm. So this is why I, as much as possible, I try to avoid the term populism. To characterize Orban in Hungary,
yeah.
or Trump in the United States, or Le Pen in France, or the ADF in Germany, and use instead something that's more related to the dialectics of class and the dialectics of left and right as political antagonists. Uh-huh. So this is why I use that.
Right. So to situate within that dialectic, I like that part because it implies a dominance and then I guess a reversal of that dominance and then again coming back to a sort of hegemony position.
Sure.
Which brings me to ask, how do we differentiate the far right today to how it looked in prior times?
You know, in the book, I borrow from a very, very important social historian named Arno Meyer. And Arno Meyer has this very important categorization of what he calls the anti-revolutionary triad. The first are reactionaries, you know, who are basically want to bring back the past. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you see many
organizations. The people wearing swastikas and
these are people that want to bring back a past of hierarchy. Mm-hmm. You find conservatives that are not so much interested in bringing the past, but they want to defend the status quo. And then the counter-revolutionaries. And the counter-revolutionaries are, you know, the people who basically, you know, use the methods of the left and methods of the revolutionaries, including mass appeal, mass propaganda, in order to be able to bring about an order that is very much against the programs of the left. So basically, if you look at National Socialism in the past, you know, they adopted some of the rhetoric of the left, but twisted that in a way by which they asserted hierarchy. They, you know, they asserted white supremacy. They asserted all these primeval values, but with a mass base. So in that way, therefore, they are different from reactionaries. They're different from conservatives. They're far more dangerous.
They have an agenda that they intend to...
Yes, well, the reactionaries and conservatives have an agenda too. But the agenda of the far right is much more opportunistic, you know, in which they will pick up all sorts of different things from the agendas of all sorts of different forces in order to bring about the kind of anti-left, anti-progressive order that they want, because they are basically against a disruption of the, you know, the world, it, which is characterized, say, by the dominance of a certain sector of the population. For instance, in the United States, you know, they want to bring about an order that brings back the era of white supremacy. But what differentiates that from many groups is that they have a big, big mass base, you know, that they can appeal to. And they use all sorts of methods in order to bring back, you know, that kind of past, you know, that nevertheless is a past that uses the methods of the present.
Some of these newly developed methods of mobilization and bringing people together.
So this is the... So I find that categorization of reactionaries, conservatives, and counter-revolutionaries very, very useful, you know. And what unites them all is that they hate the progressive movement. They hate not only the progressive movement, but liberal democracy.
Democracy in totality.
They hate socialism, okay? And you know, they will even adopt certain programs of the left in order to be able to derail the left. For instance, in Europe at this point in time, what you have is that the counter-revolutionaries basically will say, hey, we're for the welfare state too, huh? You know, but only for the dominant ethnic stock, only for the right racial stock, you know. So not for immigrants, not for colored people, not for Muslims, you know. It's for us, all the people who've been traditionally here.
It's a social program, but for us.
Yes, that's it. I mean, that's what Trump is all about. That's what racism, white nationalism is all about in the States. That's, you know, what Orban is all about. That's what Le Pen is all about. You know, it's this anti, the outsider and the traditional insider groups. We're for benefiting all of them, but we have to make it clear that the people of different color, the people of different cultures, they're not part of this process.
Is this what we see? Because the book says we're talking about the global rise of the far right, right? So abstracted from the, for instance, white supremacy agenda of Trump and what you see manifesting here in Europe, If we look at other regions of the world, if we look at India, has been called an example of this same phenomenon, and I guess Brazil, there's other places in the world. What is it at an abstracted level that these movements all have in common?
Like, well, on the one hand, they're exclusionary.
Exclusionary, yes.
You know, that basically they say that there are certain parts of the population that should be excluded from participation, either economic, social, or political participation. Or if they're included, they are mainly second-class citizens. Okay, and in India, that is Muslims. And the appeal here is that, look, were a majority Hindu nation. Okay? And what democracy means is the rule of the majority, right? So it is the rule of Hindus. Okay? And so they basically would say that this is the problem with secular democracy as represented by the Congress Party in India, because it wasn't reflecting the rule of the majority. It was in fact saying that minorities should have equal rights and they should be equally protected. And when they criticized, for instance, secularism, they would say in India, secularism has been translated into promoting special privileges for minorities. You know, that they should, you know, it says the minorities can have their own traditional cultural practices. So this kind of secularism is a false secularism because it really is promoting the rights of Muslims against the rights of Hindus. Why can't we all live, you know, in a way that reflects the cultural practices of the majority? And that's what democracy is all about. So you see, democracy is interpreted as majoritarianism.
Yeah, so that's what I was about to ask. Is this a deliberate misunderstanding of what democracy means? You think about political philosophy in the Western tradition with John Rawls and all this. These were questions that were already brought up, like the protecting minorities from the will of the majority, making sure that there's plurality, even if there's a dominant group. Is this then a deliberate disjunction from the political tradition, or is it simple ignorance?
Well, I think it is deliberate in the way that basically it is saying that the diversity, the secularism, the protection of rights of minorities, which have all developed under the rubric of liberal democracy, that's a false democracy. Because basically what they would say is that the essence of democracy is majority rule. And if it's majority rule, the way that they would define majority is the cultural or religious majority. That is what democracy is all about. So this is why, in a way, it departs from the progressive definition of democracy as well as the liberal definition of democracy. And also, a lot of the rights of the individual, the rights of communities, due process, you know, all of that, which were combined with democracy, that side is excised out. Yeah. You know, so that basically it is a rule of the majority without the protection of individual rights.
With disregard, really, for all your rights, regardless.
Right. So, in essence, of course, in the concrete, these are, you know, these are not as clear cut.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, that's the thrust of this movement at this point in time. So that's why I say that there are two kinds of counter-revolution that I distinguish in the book. The first is the counter-revolution against an insurgent lower-class movement, which I find, for instance, in Indonesia, in Chile, in Thailand, where you have a middle class based movement, you know, that is protecting what it sees as its interests against the lower classes. And then you have the kind that you see in the Philippines and in India, which is a movement against liberal democracy by people who were disappointed by the fact that this liberal democracy, which was dominated by the elites, did not deliver on its promises of democratic popular empowerment, both at the level of the economy or at the level of politics. So, and this kind of counter-revolution is also quite total. You know, it challenges so many of the, you know, it's a comprehensive ideological, political, social challenge to liberal democracies. So in other words, what you find right now in Europe and in the United States and in many parts of the global South is that the main thrust of many counter-revolutionary movements are against secular liberal democracy. And a great part of the motivation of the people who promote, who go behind them, is the disappointment with the failures of liberal democracy. That was failures because of the way that control by ruling class elites of the democratic process prevented the liberal democratic process from really fulfilling people's aspirations. So there's a lot of discontent and anger at the failure of liberal democracy. And it's because of the way that the elites basically twisted democracy in their favor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that would have been my follow-up question.
Oh, yeah, right, sure.
You know, there must be something that they're reacting to, right? Mm-hmm. That they're catering to and satisfying a sentiment, if you will, mm-hmm. that's expressing itself in multiple different ways across the earth. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it seems these are shortcomings that have come about because of the liberal,
sure.
secular liberal mm-hmm. democracy mm-hmm. framework mm-hmm. That we've been using. What are those specific weaknesses of liberal democracy? Can they be fixed? What can we do in a forward-thinking way?
Well, definitely the biggest problem of liberal democracies has been the way that the elites have promoted neoliberal policies, you know, that have created even greater inequality, you know, in the society. You know, yeah. So I think that if you look at, for instance, India and the Philippines, you have extremely unequal societies that have a secular democratic canopy. You know, and so, there was competition, but it was mainly competition among the elites that controlled the political parties.
Yeah.
And all the talk about equality was really negated by the very unequal conditions of the society. So I think that.
So we could all have one vote each, but yes. then it's different when I have a vote and a check.
Sure.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, this is one way of putting it.
Yeah.
That, in fact, liberal democracies have been hijacked by the rich,
yeah.
have been hijacked by the powerful, have mm-hmm. been hijacked by the corporations. And especially in the United States and Europe, is that the parties that were supposed to be protecting people from the elites, like the Social Democrats, all bought into neoliberalism, all bought into neoliberal principles, which created all these inequalities. And so what you found was that many people in the working class, from Sweden, you know, down to Italy, you know, that used to feel that they were represented and socially protected by the Social Democrats, found that they could no longer rely on these people because these people were the ones themselves that were promoting.
They were part of the problem.
They were part of the neoliberalism. Yeah. So these are the discontented people that were then harvested by the people on the right.
Yeah.
And so you see this very, very strongly in terms of Europe in particular. So in many ways, we can say that elites hijacking of the liberal democratic process with the cooperation of social democrats, you know, has been a central cause of the rise in the popularity of the right from people that feel that they have been marginalized.
They've been left out.
They've been left out.
They,
sure.
This then becomes an attempt to
Sure. To what the insidiousness of the right is that they would basically tell these people, you know, hey, look, we're also, you know, for equality. We're also for promoting your interests, you know. But yeah, the real problem is that the Social Democrats and those progressives and their socialists are really instruments of these immigrants. And they're the ones who are flooding this country with immigrants that are displacing you from your jobs. So that's the sort of conspiratorial connection that they make. Yeah. And unfortunately, because the Social Democrats were so implicated with the neoliberal program, they could not make...
There's no counter to that when you're part of the system.
They did not
yourself.
Have the moral authority to be able to counter that. Yeah. So basically, I think that we cannot explain the rise of the right without bringing in the co-optation of social democracy, whether it was in the Netherlands, it was in Sweden, it was in France, it was in Great Britain, the co-optation of these people into the neoliberal agenda. Okay, so this is the insidiousness of the right wing, the rhetoric, because they basically say, we're also for the welfare state, but without those people of color, without those other people who are destroying the fabric of our society. So that's the kind of counter-revolutionary kind of appeal.
That is this what you call how the right stole the left's lunch?
Yes.
I like that chapter title.
Yes.
Could you explain it a little bit more? This is the element of using... the left's form of mobilizations?
Yes. Well, all I'm trying to say there is, you know, that the criticism of globalization was originally formulated by progressives. And it was formulated by people who were discontented with the way that the Social Democrats had been hijacked or hijacked, you know, the neoliberal program. Yeah. And so it was people in the anti-globalization movement that basically were promoting anti-globalization, anti-neoliberalism. But the right saw this as an opportunity and basically then, you know, took over a program that was initially articulated by the left, which was anti-corporations, anti-globalization, but formulated that in a reactionary kind of paradigm.
So it's no globalization, and it moves instead to this conservative nationalism.
It's a mass populism. It's a mass-based program that basically would say everybody in the country except immigrants, except the people of color, except those who don't belong. Yeah. So welfare state. Yes, we're for the welfare state, but only for us, the in-group. So that's the insidiousness, and that's also part of the appeal that has not been countered by progressives. And that's the sort of big task that we really need to do is how do we counter this very dynamic and insidious, you know, way that the right has captured many of the programs and visions of the left, but applied them in an exclusionary setting. And we break that down in order to bring people back into a more progressive kind of paradigm that renounces neoliberalism, but also promotes equality among peoples, among races, among, you know, ethnic groups, you know, instead of exclusion. You know, so this is the big challenge that we have.
So in the book, you go through multiple case studies, which from what I get now can be at a broader level distinguished as the ones where you've got a middle class rising up to stop the emergent classes from taking away our food, basically. And another one where it's a reaction to neoliberal neoliberalism and liberal democracy. I mean, of course, they're very much intertwined,
sure,
right?
Sure,
it's very
sure,
much the
sure.
same thing. Is there any specific case for you that stood out from the different examples that you have? One that was peculiar in a specific way that doesn't fit into these two distinctions, or just one that is specifically memorable or different?
I've been trying to think, and you know, there could very well be some, but I've not looked at this that closely.
In this way, yeah.
You know? But those are the two broad categories that I think movements fell into. And then the third thing that I would say is very important too is the role of charismatic individuals. In Modi in India and Duterte in the Philippines, you know, are like this, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, charisma is not necessarily just one type of charisma, not just the kind of Hitler, demiurgic sort of charisma, rhetorical charisma. Mm. There's, you know, Modi, you know, embodies a sort of a charisma of, you know, mix of, you know, I'm the only one who can get India out of the rut that the Congress Party has brought us, and it is my Hindu nationalist faith that will make the difference. And then Duterte, who basically has a gangster charm, you know he doesn't hesitate to say, I'll kill you, you know. And there's a charisma in that, oh my God, this is a guy who can really discipline our people. Yeah. This is the guy we need, because we need a strong man like this guy who's willing to spit
do the
on
dirty
your face,
work,
to
yeah?
do the dirty
to
work.
Drain the swamp,
so,
or
right, that's
fight
it.
The elite.
And Trump has its own charisma to his base. You know, his extremism, and that his political style. So, you know, basically the role of individuals, we're seeing that. We're seeing that in the United States, in particular in the North at this point. Trump, the individual charisma of Trump united to his program and his personal, you know, inclinations is an extremely disruptive force that mobilizes his base, you know. So the more he becomes, you know, extreme, the more that base, you know,
fires them up.
And of course, a lot of that base is white working class. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that base is in Ohio, in Indiana, in Michigan. You know, that...
The middle part of America.
That's middle part that made the difference.
Yeah.
It elected him last time. And right now, he's appealing to that same base. And he could very well win the elections again.
So because, the rise still continues as we speak.
Right,
the rise of the far
right. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that these are complex phenomena, but they also have common characteristics.
Yeah.
You know, the reaction against liberal democracy and a progressive program, the role of the middle class, the role of a mass base, the role of a charismatic leader. Those you see in the most successful ones, you know, that... And so I would say that but the question that I have is, how come these people broke into the political scene without having been anticipated, you know?
So this is a failure somehow on the progressive movement also.
It was a failure of the progressive movement. It was a failure of academics. Mm-hmm. It was a failure of political analysts.
Yeah.
It was
I mean, the morning of the announcement of, for instance, Trump's election, nobody saw it coming.
Sure. You know, like these people in 2010, the right-wing movements were all marginal in practically all areas.
Yeah.
I mean, they were making significant challenges in France and everything. 2019, you have Trump in the United States. ADF has, 20% of the seats in parliament in Germany. The Nordic Social Democrats have mm-hmm. been in chaos, and they've had to adopt the program of the right in around mm-hmm. immigration in Sweden. Yeah. In Italy, you had the rise of, you know, Salvini. Mm-hmm. And in Hungary, you had Viktor Orban, you know, who's now the most successful counter-revolutionary in power. And so this is why, you know, the big question is, just like the failure, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern mm-hmm. European countries in the late 80s and 1990s were not anticipated, this rise of the right has also been not anticipated.
Almost came out of the blue.
And in many ways, many of us share the blame in the sense that we were either so focused on a classical class analysis, mm-hmm. you know, in which, you know, it was mainly, you know, the conflict was between the masses and the corporate elite. And liberal Democrats were so content that, oh my God, as Fukuyama said, you know, that this is...
history's over.
History's over. It's liberal democracy. That's the only alternative. You know, so on the one hand...
So premature celebration on the part of...
Premature celebration on the part of the liberal Democrats. And the left was so focused on classical class analysis. Mm-hmm. And then, boom, you have this emergence of mass-based right-wing movements that spouse anti-neoliberal rhetoric, but for ends which are anti-progressive. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of, you know, people had thought that the Nazi and fascist movements, oh, they would never come back.
This would never happen again.
Yeah, right? That this was never happening again because people have learned their lessons. Now, I think that... So I think it's very important that we understand the kind of intellectual lapses mm-hmm. on the part of progressives as well as the part of liberal analysts.
Yeah.
You know, that they were frozen by their paradigms and failed, in fact, to anticipate the emergence of these movements. Now, I, however, was always very, very worried about the potential of the right. Mm. And I was worried about the potential of the right when I did my dissertation in Chile. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that, wow, this middle class that political scientists are saying is the base of democracy in the world.
And just for context, this is in the 70s, right?
The 70s.
Yeah.
I see them, in fact, leading the mm-hmm. attacks against Allende, the attacks against the left, and the beating up people. And these were not people, sure, the right wing was manipulating them, but they had their own dynamic. Mm-hmm. And what they feared was that the rise of the poor people would mean the loss of their middle class status, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
So ever since then, I have always been very, very wary mm-hmm. of the middle class. And then I saw this happening again in Thailand, mm-hmm. in the period from 2001 to 2014, where you had a populist program on the a populist leader like Thaksin, who was mobilizing the lower classes. It was the middle class mm-hmm. that basically mobilized and got the military to intervene and throw him out. And then I saw that again in the Philippines, where suddenly, out of nowhere, Duterte becomes, boom, the savior of the middle classes and the savior of the Philippines against all these jerks that said that who were always speaking about democracy and everything is, you know, so I guess
there's always a strand somewhere that pointed
at
what was coming. Just
sure. That I was always worried about that. I was mm-hmm. always very sensitive mm-hmm. to this process of middle class mass based mobilization, mm-hmm. and So I, in fact, my PhD dissertation on Chile centered around this. I said, in the thesis itself, I said that basically we cannot understand what happened in the overthrow of Allende unless we see that this was a mass-based counter-revolution. And it wasn't the CIA, for Christ's sake, that overthrew Allende. Yes, the CIA played a role, but the CIA's role was only effective in the context of this broad counter-revolutionary middle-class mass movement. So I think that my thesis was probably the only one
that actually pointed to this.
But now it's accepted.
Yeah.
You know, after so many years in which the explanation of Allende was that he was overthrown by the CIA, you know, now people are beginning to understand the fact. Yeah, and that the central factor was a counter-mobilization that was not, you know, the Americans did help in it, but they were not the central actors. And I fear that today we might be falling into the same trap in the sense that progressives just would say, oh, it's the elites manipulating people. It's the elites manipulating the masses. It's the elites manipulating the middle class. And not understanding the internal dynamics of these movements, that they are reactive and counter-revolutionary, and that they're fluid, and that they're very, very complex coalitions, you know, that... and unless you really go to that level and try to understand that, and you just dismiss it and just say, "Hey, it's manipulation."
This makes me wonder. When I look at the book, indeed we're talking about the global rise of the far right, but that's because, isn't really global, because perhaps there's some areas of the world where the far right hasn't risen, right?
Yeah.
So is it then that this form of middle-class mobilization that characterizes the far right is a precondition for it, such that the places where you haven't seen it are places that had not developed this
to some extent type of a I would say class. That, yes, I think we need to investigate that.
Because why is it not a characteristic? We're seeing it somewhere in elements of it.
Sure.
The exclusion. We just had xenophobic attacks in South Africa, for instance, and a lot of the rhetoric. It's not official government rhetoric. It's not coming from the people in power, really. It's more from the threatened middle class that is now trying to throw out immigrants and fellow Africans.
Yeah.
Why is it that we see this phenomenon in Europe and in now in South America and Brazil, but not in some other regions of the world?
Well, I think to some extent it's countries that have developed
a big enough
middle class in the global South, and in Europe and the United States by a working class that was used to seeing itself as middle class, and that was enjoying the benefits of middle class status, and suddenly feeling that they're being threatened by immigrants coming in, that they would take away that status. Power. And so, so I think, yes, to some extent, you don't have as powerful a movement like this and in a number of other countries because of the level of, you know, they haven't really sufficiently developed that kind of large middle class. Although even now you'll see that there are elements of this middle class, you know, that are already active in this kind of way, but still have not the critical mass.
Well, so now to round off, I mean, it's a good thing that we're talking about this in the form, in the context of a dialectic, right? There's an emergent far right, emerged by now. It seems to be pretty much on its way to some sort of hegemony. What must progressive movements do to now counter? I mean, if we're going to have a change in the power relations, what should be done now, and what can be done to prevent?
I think this in the future? You know, several things. One is that let's give up the notion that this is just manipulation by the elites. Mm-hmm. You know, let's give up conspiracy theories about the rise of the middle class. Let's not give the corporate elites this all-knowing power that they know what to do. You know, and in fact, they themselves, you know, are oftentimes stymied by the rise of these people. Third is, I think we really need to come out in very vigorous defense of democratic rights, of due process, of the rights of the individual, because it's very tempting at this point in time to retreat from those in the face of this attacks by the right. Then I think that we really need to look at, you know, what are the movements or what are the parts of the sectors of the population that are particularly vulnerable, but at the same time, particularly active in countering the right. And I think the women's movement is very important because these right-wing movements are very misogynistic. So I think women should be in the cutting edge of this movement. And then I think that we really need to be able to promote a vision of democracy, you know, that is really centered on equality, that basically, you know, we go beyond the sort of defense of liberal democracy that is a form, you know, defense of formal equality, but substantive inequality. Mm-hmm. And we really need to say central to this whole program is the elimination of inequality. And you know, let's make that very central.
Equal regard for all bodies, black, white, it doesn't matter, male, but female.
Yes, and not only that, it's got to be centered on real economic equality. We bust up the corporations, we bust up, you know, all those structures that promote economic and social inequality at this point in time. And that's going to be, you know, that's very important. And finally, we do need to look at the way that the left works, because the strength of the left is always has been its rational analysis, but it's also been its weakness in that sometimes it becomes too rationalistic in the way that it approaches political mobilization. Mm-hmm. Whereas the right, the weakness of the right has always been its irrationality, but it's also been its appeal to emotions that has been its strength. So how can we combine reason and emotion in a program, you know, that appeals to the basic constituencies of the progressive movement, class and sectoral constituencies? So I think that's the big challenge at this point in time. I do not mean we go into the same kind of reactionary, counter-revolutionary, charismatic politics, emotions. You know. Yeah. But I'm just saying that there are some, you know, that we have to be able to capture the gut feel of peoples. Mm-hmm. That, you know, that basically the appeal of people like Trump is they are able to capture the stomach, the pit of the stomach.
The strength of rational arguments right now no longer is sufficient.
Sure. Yeah, a, right. So you have to be able to do that, but do that in a progressive way that shows people that basically the right is not the solution. It is still basically moving forward towards a society of real equality. Mm-hmm. So what is the answer? I think that whether you call it socialism, whether you call it social democracy, whether you call it popular democracy, it's really, really, you know, a program based on real equality. That is the answer at this point in time. And I think that it will necessarily be an anti-capitalist program.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. TNI is an international research and advocacy institute committed to building a just, democratic, and sustainable planet. This podcast is just one way in which we share the ideas and thoughts of the activists and scholars in our network. This episode features a conversation with Walden Bella, based on his book, Counter Revolution, The Global Rise of the Far Right. For more than four decades, TNI has supported the major social movements of the day, providing them with research, ideas, as well as logistical support. We're based in Amsterdam, and we believe there are alternatives to the world as it currently exists. We hope you believe this too. Thank you so much for listening this far. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. You can begin by clicking on the donate button on our website. If you'd like to find out more about TNI's work, please look us up on www.tni.org and find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook.